lickety-split fashion.
That's what they call me on the beat, lickety-split.
Lickety-split Weeder. Dan Weeder.
We'll mention this mainly because Dan Weeder said we would mention this nugget.
Bears beat report.
This will be my last week at the Chicago Tribune after 12 years at the Chicago Tribune. It is a bittersweet moment for me. It's a strange moment for me. Kid from Chicago growing up and always wanted to work at the Chicago Tribune and getting the dream job. Insanely, after 12 years, it's coming to an end.
Co-host of the Take the North podcast.
Really did a good job following the board, kind of letting it talk to us.
I mean, sometimes the board says things to you that you weren't expecting it to say. You know, it's kind of like a wife. And so, like, you got to listen to what it says and then follow its orders.
Dan Weederer.
Dan Weederer. Go ahead, Dan.
With Spiegel and Holmes on 670 The Score.
I'm so happy that we didn't lose Dan Weederer to another team or another city or another profession.
Yeah, I was worried there for a little while.
I was too.
Yeah.
But I'm always worried.
That's your default. That's your bit.
That is my bit. Dan Weederer covers the Bears for The Athletic. He is also part of the Take the North podcast, which you can hear with our buddy Mark Grody. And he joins us now on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. Weedsy, what's up, man?
Hey, you guys were in a whole different pocket of Worry Town, weren't you?
We were.
Well, Lawrence, this is why Lawrence is the mayor. There's neighborhoods for so many different things in Worry Town. Yeah. And he checks in. Different aldermen all work there for him.
Yeah, you got to knock on doors and find out what's going on with people. And a lot of people
I've got property there. Don't worry. It's just a matter of where that land is.
So what do you worry about in terms of the Bears, Dan Weederer of The Athletic and The Score? What do you worry about? Or let's say this. What section of Worry Town should be the most populous at this moment in Bears terms?
Okay. The most populated section of Worry Town. I think probably you're looking at the left side of the offensive line and trying to figure out how they're going to stabilize that starting left tackle position. And I think you really want to keep your eyes on how quickly the quarterback development plan is taking root, because this is a race. That's what the head coach told us. And, you know, they're going to have to keep up in that race so that they're not really chasing when it gets too hard to chase.
Well, go back to that then. So start there, because I think that's the main focus or the main opportunity for Worry. Where do you think the development plan stands? How do you feel about where we stand right now?
Well, believe it or not, one 7-play touchdown drive in the second preseason game in August does not instantly cure all problems at the quarterback position. I know that one was a little bit hard for some folks in Chicago to realize last Monday. But I do think that there's a lot here on Caleb's plate. He's learning a new system. He's got a whole new set of demands from this very demanding head coach. We've spent a lot of time since the spring and all throughout training camp getting him to focus on the operational stuff, everything that happens from the time he hears the play call to the time he gets the football in his hands. And so that's been a very time-consuming process to get him functional in a portion of the quarterback duties that are mandatory to be very functional. And so when we get to Monday night on September 8th, there's not going to be a lot of margin for error. There's not going to be a lot of patience for some of the hiccups that are still going to be inevitable. And so the quarterback's going to have to glide through those. He's going to have to do so with sort of his own grace. He's going to have to do so without getting frustrated. He's going to have to do so while being competent with all the post-snap stuff they're asking him to do. And it's just, I think it's going to be bumpy for a little while. And then it's just I think a matter of how Ben and Caleb together navigate those bumpy patches.
We've heard a lot of people talk about Ben maybe overloading Caleb Williams on purpose. How do you see that working out? And for the fans, like, wait, what do you mean? Can you break that down on what it looks like from day to day?
Well, look, I mean, like, part of it is just the volume of install in the first half of training camp, where you're just, you know, you're getting new plays and new concepts and new everything day after day after day after day. And so you're not getting to really review a lot, you know. And Caleb even said in the postgame, I think it was Sunday night, like, now that we are sort of done with that whole process, now you get a chance to rep things, and you get to go over them, and you get to review them, and you get to get comfortable in them. And so that's the process here that's always fascinating for me as you kind of cross the bridge from the preseason to the regular season, is just how you refine all that volume, how you get it down into something that makes sense for you offensively, big picture wise. And then ultimately you're going to have to start to get it to make sense for what the opponent is in week one against the Vikings to have success there. There's just a lot here on Caleb's plate, and it's a big year, but it's also not the deadline year for him, right? Like, I think we tend to forget that in Chicago because we've just been through so much with Mitch, so much with Justin, that it feels like the answer needs to be had by Halloween. And really, the Bears have time with this, with Caleb, but they don't have a lot of time either. And so it is always that high wire act that everybody's got to kind of traverse, and we'll see just kind of how it goes.
Dan, when we think about production in this offense from wide receivers, you think of Roma Dunze and DJ Moore and Luther Burden as well. But when you think about the functionality of the offense, the guy you wrote about, Olamide Zaccheaus, ought to be at the forefront of people's minds. What is important about the connection that Caleb Williams has with that particular player and the role he plays?
It's one word, Speaks. It's trust. It's the fact that Zaccheaus is so assignment sound. It's that he is so reliable in terms of every single play doing what's asked of him. If he's blocking for a ball carrier, he does that well. If he's, you know, running a route that's supposed to open things up for someone else, he does that well. When the ball's coming his way, he does that well. And so he's created a trust both with Caleb and with Ben, his play caller, that is going to make him, you know, a big part of what they're trying to do when they go into the early parts of the regular season. I think the other thing here that's really important in a Ben Johnson offense is the concept of yak, right? Like, he is big into distributing the football, getting it into the hands of the playmakers in space, and letting them do the rest. And so when you see him take a little, you know, 8-yard pass last week and go the next 28 by himself, you say, ah, yes, this is a prime example of what Ben's trying to get done with this point guard mentality for his quarterback. Let some of the other guys do some of the heavy lifting, and then ultimately finish with an end zone party. And so that's going to be fascinating to watch, to see how well they do. The Lions led the NFL last year in yards after the catch, and the Bears are going to try to close that gap this year with the playmakers that they have, as long as Caleb understands that he's just got to be, for a majority of most games, a distributor, a point guard, to get the ball in their hands, and Zaccheaus is one of those guys.
You know, it's interesting. When you look at yards after catch, you know, and you're thinking, like, it's a lot of slot. Is Zaccheaus going to be in the slot? Does it comp to Amon-Ra St. Brown? You know, like, are you finding any sort of specific comps there from Ben Johnson offense, or are you thinking larger than that?
Ben is just so kind of innovative week to week, player to player, that I think he's going to move a lot of pieces around. There may be times where Zaccheaus is running routes that Jahmyr Gibbs ran. You know, there may be times that DJ is doing the Amon-Ra stuff. There's going to be a lot of mixing and matching given the personnel that they have and the versatility of personnel they have in all three of those playmaking position groups on offense. And so this is where Ben's at his best. This is where his sort of offensive intelligence and aggression will show itself. And then ultimately, you just got to get all these guys, as Ben has harped on since the very first practice of OTAs, to understand that every little detail matters. And if we tend to the details, again, the credibility is, my offense scored 68 touchdowns last year in Detroit. So if you do this right, we can start to have some of that fun that you haven't had here in Chicago for a long time.
A year ago, we were spending a lot of time talking about the extension that DJ Moore got. And then the season didn't go the way that I think anyone expected. And he was kind of the face of the frustration on offense. With Caleb, we're talking about a full breaking down of a player to build him back up. I'm curious on what DJ Moore's camp has been like, because there does seem to be a level of them challenging him in a lot of different ways.
Well, Antoine Rendell said something in the spring that stuck with me, and it was something to the effect of that, like, DJ's had a ton of proven production in this league, but he's not a playoff receiver yet. And that meant that DJ's never played in a playoff game. And so that the next challenge and the goal for this coaching staff was to get him to understand what that next level looks like, to understand what high-level receiving play means in January and into February, if you can get that far. And so there's been a kind of a push for him to be dialed in every single period of every single day to know what that next jump could be for him. Talent-wise, it's all there. You put him in this offense and there's going to be opportunities. I mean, you've already seen Ben experimenting with DJ as a ball carrier out of the backfield in a running back position. And so they're going to find ways to use his strengths, which is getting him the football and letting him do some of the stuff that DJ does best. It's got to be matched and reciprocated with sort of a daily intensity and a daily effort that translates, you know, particularly on game night. And so that's, I think, one of the next steps for DJ. And I think the Bears feel very fortunate to have a guy like Antoine coaching those receivers, because he is very well respected and he does coach with a level of passion and energy that resonates. And so all those guys in that room, I think, are responding to that so far.
So there's a football game tonight. The Bears and the Chiefs play tonight. Dan, who's...
What time?
That's a good question.
7 o'clock.
Thank
it'll,
you,
it'll
Lawrence.
It'll be on Fox for people that want to watch the game.
Thank you, Lawrence. Also, Lawrence, how long is the first team offense going to be in? Do you know? Do you have that?
Dan would be a better choice to ask that question.
I don't think he knows. Nobody... Right?
I'm going to guess a series.
Okay. Who's playing for a roster spot in this game tonight, in your mind?
Yeah, you know, we were kind of starting to put together our 53-man projections and sifting through what this all looks like at this stage of camp. Now, I do always remind people that you have more practice squad spots than ever before. You've got 16, and so there's just a little bit more flexibility than there used to be when we get down to cut day. But when you look at this roster right now, you're talking about offensive line spots 8, 9, and 10, question mark on the 10. You're talking about wide receiver number 6. You're talking about probably running back number 4 and maybe cornerback number 6. Like those are the spots on the roster you're looking at. You guys know very well that special teams plays a role in all of those bottom of the roster decisions, and then health plays a role in that. And so the Bears sort of injury report list as they come out of this game tonight is going to be really important to look at as they put those pieces together. If you want to dive into any one of those four positions that I named, you know, like what does this mean for a Tyler Scott? What does it mean for a Nick McLeod? What does it mean for an Ian Wheeler, or even a Travis Homer? You know, those are some guys that are out there. Even a Karana Magaji, who was competing for the starting left tackle job and is sort of faded to the background. And you just wonder how they're going to structure their offensive line depth for week one in a way that makes sense with tackles and interior guys.
Let's go back to the left tackle position overall. It seems like a bit of a failure that Ozzie isn't the left tackle, but I also understand, like, he's a rookie being asked to switch to one of the toughest positions on the football field. So I'm not surprised by that. How comfortable are they if they walk into the season with Braxton Jones as their left tackle?
Moderately. I think that there have been moments in the last 4 weeks where they're like, there's the Braxton of old. There's the Braxton who has full faith in his ankle, who's playing aggressively, who's showing that he can be reliable on the blind side over there. And then there are moments where the consistency drops, and then you can almost see some of the doubt creep into Braxton's head as he's still kind of overcoming the mental hurdles of having, you know, rehab through a very, very serious ankle injury surgery rehab process. And so that's why when we started our conversation right in the town square of Worry Town, that's where I pointed the GPS was over to that left tackle position, because it is something to worry about. And guys, I go back even further, because you guys may remember in April they were in position potentially to take Calvin Banks, the very well-regarded offensive tackle. And he went one spot before them, and they wound up taking Colston Loveland. And you sort of wonder how much different this conversation would have been if Calvin Banks had been there. There are some people that tell you they would have taken Colston Loveland regardless. I have my doubts about that. And I just wonder how different this conversation would be if they used their top 10 pick in April on a left tackle, and we didn't spend the last month trying to figure out which of the four competitors for this job are least worrisome going into the season open.
I was just looking, the alderman in Worrytown for the left tackle district is Jamarcus Webb. He's the guy. And Frank Omiel used to have the job.
Yeah, but scandal.
Yeah. there was a scandal,
and then we had to move on, special election. Jamarcus had a catchphrase or something, a nickname, or I forget what it was.
I don't remember, but
the guy.
Worrytown is filthy, just politically.
How dare you?
Inside deals.
Well, the offensive line district of Worrytown for the Bears during my time on the beat has been something over there, right? Like, if you go through the probably 60 names of guys who have made at least one start on the offensive line since I started 12 years ago, you'd probably lose your mind going through that inventory.
All right, let's not do that. All right, so running backs, does Britton
Michael Ola.
There you go.
Wow.
does Britton Brown have a chance to make this team?
The health factors in at the rest of the positions, right? Like at running back, you're dealing with, you know, Roschon Johnson's been out now for a couple weeks with a foot issue. Travis Homer has been dealing with a calf issue.
How do they feel about Roschon Johnson, Dan? How do they feel about him?
I don't know, because I wanted more to occur in training camp. And then honestly, I think the last time we saw him was in that much renowned, highly physical war practice that they had the week of the Dolphins joint practices. And we haven't seen Roschon since. And so he hasn't had preseason game action to get out there. He hasn't had the meat of camp here over the last 2 weeks to continue putting his best foot forward. And so it's hard to get a full evaluation of what this new staff thinks and what their vision for him is. And so that's one of those ones that I'm interested to see how it kind of plays out, how that position group comes together, and then kind of how they you know, put together a game plan with obviously DeAndre Swift being your main back, but then trying to find some compliments there too.
312 texter, thank you. Yes, J Webb Nation. That's what Jamarcus used to talk about. Jamarcus Webb fans were J Webb Nation. And I appreciate him for that. Now that we're pretty much through training camp, because I technically training camp is over. That's the in the calendar that we're in where it's over. What's your biggest takeaway about Ben Johnson, head coach of the Chicago Bears?
I'm glad you asked me this because it gives me a chance to tease two things I've got coming in two different places. The last thing that I wrote for the Chicago Tribune was a Ben Johnson takeout that will be in your Sunday newspaper this week. It kind of dials in on Ben Johnson's presence and why it matters in general and why it matters more here. So that's something that I think has really struck me since January, is just how you know, significant his presence is and how it's been felt by everyone. The people above him, the people in the locker room, the people in the media, everybody is kind of responding to Ben's presence. Then there's this other side of him that was hired to do a job here, which is to bring the best out of Caleb Williams, to take this Bears offense to levels that it's never been at. And that part of Ben Johnson is we're still getting to know, but it's fascinating because it is much more than just a brainy guy coming up with cool concepts on you know, blueprint paper and then bringing them to life. This is a guy who's ultra aggressive, ultra fearless, very obsessed with the details. And all of those things have resonated here throughout the duration of training camp and even going back into the spring. And so I'm very interested to see where Ben takes this journey, because I know he's taking it with a level of fearlessness that's really cool. And I think the players so far have responded to it. Now we got to see what happens when a couple losses pile up and how everybody responds when the tension gets a little bit higher than it's been since he got here.
Okay. And then was there something else you wanted to mention from The Athletic, I thought?
Well, that was the second part, the offensive visionary part of Ben Johnson.
Okay, good.
We'll dive into in a couple of weeks as we get closer to the opener, still doing a little bit more reporting on that end.
So question about that. I said at the top of the show, I find myself a little more interested/impressed with Tyson Bagent now that I know it's not like a Luke Getsy Senior Bowl find or a Ryan Poles lucky scout pickup or a Shane Waldron, I'll just use what I have kind of thing. It's a Ben Johnson sanctioned 2-year extension with some lavish praise. I find myself giving Tyson a little more time of day.
Lavish praise, right? And it was sincere the other day to hear both those guys talk about each other. I think you guys probably both felt that in hearing the sincere appreciation that they both have for working with one another. They share a very similar level of passion, a very similar level of ambition. And I think when you put two people like that together and it clicks like that, you can get some really cool results out of it. I think both of them envision some really cool results coming out of this development process. And so, you know, like, it's cool to watch Tyson Bagent go from QB4 as an undrafted rookie out of Shepherd a couple years ago to a guy that now feels like he's got the world in front of him and is just going to attack it the same way he's always attacked it, with the belief that he can reach the highest level of his potential, you know? And so that's what the Bears are going to give him the opportunity to do. And I do think that union between him and Ben has been very genuine and very energizing for the two of them.
The Bears secondary has been a strength for this team for the last couple of years. They've got guys you're like, man, that guy could probably start for someone else. How important is it that they go into the season intact, or can they skate by with some injuries considering their depth?
I think when you're trying to create momentum for a season like this, that you want to be as close to full health as you possibly can be. And I think with what Dennis Allen has done over the last few months to kind of get an identity created in this defense as a whole, having those secondary playmakers, we're talking about Jalen and Kyler specifically, having them ready to go on opening night on the Monday night stage gives you just a whole extra level of juice, a whole extra level of edge That's really helpful. And so they can get to skate by, but we've been skating by in Worrytown for a long time. The skating rink has been well used in Worrytown. It's time to do something other than skate by, right? And start to create different pockets that are much more energizing. And so I, it seems like both those guys are trending in the right direction. And hopefully they're ready to go. They're going to have an opportunity in that opener to play a Vikings team that's a little depleted in the receiving core. He's got a second year quarterback making his first career start. You've got a chance to really dictate things in that game, and to do so, having your best players available would really help.
Yeah, they said the Vikings checked in on Adam Thielen down there in Carolina. That's how desperate they are. They're looking for anything they can get.
Well, yeah. Jordan Addison is suspended for the first 3 weeks, and they got some injuries too. And it's like
they still got Justin. You
correct.
Know? So like that guy. I think I've seen him go over 100 yards in the first quarter against the Bears at least once. And so, you still got a game plan for him. But ultimately, I think DA is really trying to put together a plan here that allows the Bears to be really, really aggressive.
You know, Jalen will be back for that,
especially now that he has the space to just follow JJ.
Oh my God. Like he's gonna, maybe you don't know that. I was just me guessing how much he wants that, you know?
No question. Yeah, no question. And so hopefully that he's out there. I always like to see guys practice a little bit and look at it with my own eyes.
I really just to
see it, just to make sure that there are no lingering effects. We don't really know how this whole thing occurred at this point, you know? And so it's kept him out for more than a month now, and you got to start to get ready to go play high level football really quick, and there's a conditioning aspect to that as well.
I'm really happy for you if you're happy for you. If you like it, I love it. Oh, with this move to the Athletic,
I love it. I love it. I'll say this, I've said this to a few friends and family, it's the first time in a while I've had a tailwind, and it's a really cool feeling to have when you've got a little bit of that wind behind you to go do what you want. So it's going to be fun in the months and years ahead to go on this next phase of this journey.
Very cool. And very cool to see you and the family in the broadcast booth at Wrigley last week. That's quite a view
up
there.
Very cool to see you do the play-by-play up there while we were up there. That was a fun little treat to have you in there and to see a Cubs win, a 3-1 win there. That was probably closer than it needed to be in that game. But yeah, it was an enjoyable experience. My son had been up there once or twice before. First time for my wife and daughter to go in there and see Coom and Zach and Speaks do their thing in the radio booth.
Sir, we are happy for you. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
All right, guys. Enjoy the weekend.
Man. That is Dan Wiederer. He'll take over for me when I step down.
Wait, from where? What do you mean?
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Worrytown.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he had me going there. It was, it was the earlier conversation about being surrounded by doofuses. Yeah. Or doofy? Is it doofy?
Countdown clock ass. Is 2 years.
Montreal pending.
And so I guess we're technically at about 22 months.
I mean,
if we're counting.
Look, let's be honest. For me, if I last that long with a partner, that's a news story these days.
Well, we're coming up on a year, Speaks.
Yeah, so we'd have about 3 years by then.
Yeah. But I mean, like, you blink and we've been doing this show for a year.
Man, you'd think we'd be better by now.
That's what I was hoping.
Well, that's why Sean Sears is here.
He's making he really sure.
Is. And it's for good, everyone.
For those who don't know, Alex Kuhn is listening on his plane back from Spain in just one of the worst choices one could ever make for in-flight entertainment.
I will say I cannot wait to hear what he did over there. Because he said that he ran into a bunch of Bulls fans, or at least people wearing Bulls paraphernalia.
They were all Danny Parkins. You remember that, Danny?
Oh, that's right. He did travel.
He traveled Europe wearing like a Fridge t-shirt and an NBA Jam t-shirt on a gondola in Venice.
I wonder if there's some commerce that can happen with that. If there's someone over there, like if Danny was wearing like a really nice like Bulls like jersey or something, if someone would be like, hey, I would like that,
yeah.
And I will pay you for it.
You think it's possible Alex Kuhn saw somebody wearing Danny Parkins' old jersey? Is that where you're going?
Danny is someone, he's smart. He's a shrewd businessman. So make that deal. And I hope that Alex made that deal because he's a producer. Doesn't make a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, he's in Spain, though. I mean, he's on his flight listening back.
It's just stupid.
So dumb.
It's really. It makes me question a lot.
The hire. You had a question?
Honestly. No, we're just kidding, Alex.
That's why we got Sean Sears on speed dial.
We adore you. We're going to take a break. When we come back, it was a really emotional day at Old St. Pat's. Rhino's funeral was today, and there were a lot of people who spoke beautifully about him. A friend of our show did as well. We will share that with you next here on The Score.
Spiegel and Holmes.
Bob Costas.
Matt, thank you very much. And Lawrence, stop dominating the conversation the way you have over the last several minutes, really.
Afternoons on The Score.
He was a humble man, and he lifted us up with his smile and a beautiful, beautiful heart that knew nothing else than just how to love. That was Ryne Sandberg. As I stand here today, I have a confession to make, because in many ways I feel very, very awkward being here. Because except for Mayor Richard M. Daley and I think Mr. Reinsdorf is here, I'm a Sox fan. It's a confession that I need to make. And Mary made this stole for me, but inside she actually put the Sox logo on the inside, just so you know. It's full transparency today in terms of who I am, but I may not have grown up a Cubs fan, but I sure am a Ryne Sandberg fan, like all of you and many, many others, especially on the South Side.
That's Father Thomas Hurley, and that's the most White Sox thing ever. Ever.
To have the White Sox logo on the inside?
At the Rhino funeral. Like, gotta represent. And knowing that there are White Sox luminaries in the house, like Frank Thomas was there today, Jerry Reinsdorf was there. That's some wild stuff.
The name just rang a bell, and I checked my text. I forgot. Tributosaurus played a gig at Marist a couple summers ago, and Father Tom Hurley is the one who booked us over there because he's director of advancement over at Marist High School.
Yeah. You didn't book him for the show today?
I should have.
I'm waiting for the text of you remembering how you and the Pope played in a band together, and yet we still have no Pope on this show.
I probably did see Lori Lightfoot play trumpet at the Elbow Room back in the 90s. She was in a
She's pretty
a
easy to find these days. We could probably book her now.
Well, nah, I'm good.
You know, she's out there stomping out corruption in Thornton. You know, doing the job that I think that she is totally qualified to do.
Anyway, I'll pick up that name I just dropped right there.
You love it. You love it.
So, hoodles.
Our friend Bob Costas was there today, and he was front row. It was really cool to see all the people that came out to send Rhino off, and hearing the stories. His son was so beautiful, talking about their relationship and talking about how he had to learn how to finish his homework before he got home, because whenever he would get home, Ryne would be like, hey, let's go play basketball, or let's go play ping pong, or let's hang out. So he figured out how to do his homework before he got home, so they would have all the time in the world. His daughter was really great, talking about the prankster that Rhino was. Here's our buddy Bob Costas with a eulogy of Ryne Sandberg.
Thank you, Father, and thank you for presiding in such wonderful and touching fashion. You know, it's really something when the priest is a better speaker than the broadcaster. But we'll do our best. As we gather here in memory of Hall of Famer Ryne Sandberg, and with Hall of Famers like Andre Dawson and Joe Torre, and I see Billy Williams and Jim Thome and Ozzie Smith here today, all of you, whether you realize it or not, are heeding the wise words of Hall of Famer Yogi Berra, who once said, always go to your friends' funerals, otherwise they won't come to yours. So true. On behalf of everyone here today, and for so many more here in spirit, heartfelt sympathy to Margaret and the entire Sandberg family. We recognize that the loss of Ryne is most deeply felt and most truly understood by those closest to him. But we hope there's a measure of comfort in knowing how admired, respected, and beloved your husband, father, grandfather, and brother was by those who played those he played with, by Cub fans, of course, and also by baseball fans across America who might not have been Cub rooters, but who recognized excellence, grace, and class when they saw it. In a few minutes, Ryan's daughter Lindsay and son Justin will offer more deeply personal thoughts than I possibly could, but Margaret asked me to speak today, I guess, to touch upon what baseball meant to Ryan and what he meant to the game. Among the many things that sets baseball apart is that in baseball, history matters and memories resonate more than in any other sport. No better example than June 23rd, 1984, the Sandberg game, a regular season game that has a name, a single game that has had at least three documentaries made about it, a game that young fans know about today and fans generations from now will know about because it's a lasting part of Cub and baseball lore. In truth, I was little more than a bit player that day. I called the game on NBC. But somehow, that alone created a four-decade connection and friendship between Ryan and me, and it seemed that it was always topic number one every time our paths crossed, and it's the reason I'm standing here today. Sure. The game was a classic. The setting, perfect Saturday afternoon at Wrigley Field. The rivals, the Cardinals and the Cubs. And the fact that it was the NBC game of the week, back when the game of the week meant something very different. Very few games were nationally televised. Back then, those Saturday games often got higher ratings than some postseason games get today. So the whole nation, at least all the baseball fans it seemed, were watching that game. And the game was insane. The Cubs were down 7-1, they were down 9-3, they were down 9-8 when they came up in the ninth. Hall of Famer Bruce Sutter trying to close it out for the Cardinals when Ryan Sandberg homered to tie the game. Willie McGee hit for the cycle that day for the Cardinals, and his double produced the go-ahead run in the 10th, then he scored an insurance run, 11-9. Two outs, nobody on, bottom of the 10th inning, Bobby Dernier works a walk on a 3-2 pitch, up comes Ryan Sandberg again, Suter's still on the mound, and he homers to almost exactly the same place in the bleachers. It was almost like the same fan could have caught both. Now the place is going completely bananas, as Harry Carey put it. The game is tied again, we move on to the 11th, and who gets the winning hit? The last guy available on the Cub bench, Davey Owens, because, well, that's just baseball. A game in which someone who hit for the cycle is a footnote. The Sandberg game. Now, in truth, both before and since, there have been some games, a few, not many, and some individual performances, again, a few, not many, that were comparable. But they just don't feel the same way because they didn't have all the elements all at once, including the perfect leading man. But perhaps the real and lasting significance of that game is that not only is it the signature game of an MVP season and a Hall of Fame career, not only did it serve notice to the rest of the country that the long woebegone Cubs were actually contenders, but that day and that season personified a drastically changed dynamic around the Cubs. Now, this is not to shortchange the Cubs of Ernie Banks and Ron Santo and Ferguson Jenkins and Billy Williams, but it had been a long time since the Cubs felt relevant. And all of a sudden, so many things came together all at once. Dallas Green had remade the team. WGN had become a superstation, so now there were Cub fans all around the country. Harry Carey, father, had come over from the South Side, bringing with him a certain measure of energy and personality. And so, the whole vibe around the team had changed, and that game personified it. From that point forward, through good seasons and bad, it's never gone back to what it once was. The Cubs were still beloved, sure, but now they were cool, and a hot ticket, and the phrase, plenty of good seats still available, was seldom heard again around Wrigley Field. And for the first decade plus of this reimagining of what the Cubs were about, the face of the team, the signature player, the number 23 in Chicago before Michael Jordan, was Ryne Sandberg. The stats alone, the 9 gold gloves, the 10 all-star appearances, the record at the time for career home runs by a second baseman, would have brought Ryne to Cooperstown. But beyond that, and in addition to the All-American boy appeal, what endeared him to fans and earned him universal respect within the game wasn't just what he did, but the way he did it. He was a flawless all-around player, talented and fundamentally sound, the kind of player any dad or youth coach could point to and say, that's the way you play the game. The way he approached the game, the way he played, was a result of who he was. And when his time at Cooperstown came, Ryne Sandberg, usually quiet and reserved, made a strong point about himself and his regard for the game. Here's part of what he said. Make a great play, act like you've done it before. Get a base hit, look for the coach, and get ready to run the bases. Hit a home run, put your head down, drop the bat, and run around the bases, because the name on the front is more important than the name on the back. That's respect. Many years later, on June 23rd, 2024, the 40th anniversary of the Sandberg game, the Cubs, as you know, unveiled a statue in Ryne's honor at Wrigley Field. And at his request, that statue does not depict him in some heroic posture, to follow through on a home run. A spectacular play, the signature for Ryne would have been ranging to his right and behind the bag at second base, making that whirling throw to first. No, here's what he wanted, and here's what he got. A statue of him in position, in fundamental position, ready to make any play, including the routine play. And on that day, among those he asked to speak were Larry Boa and Sean Dunston, a nod toward his double play partners for all those years with the Cubs. The one memory that stands out most for me of that day was something that hadn't been planned. I looked behind me as I was introducing Ryne, and I saw up on the catwalk overlooking Gallagher Way, the entire Cub team led out there by Craig Counsell in uniform, just silently looking on. A sign of true respect, a grace note. Just as Ryne, a man who made history without histrionics, would have wanted it. Through the years, stories abound of Ryne's kindness and generosity of spirit to just about everyone he encountered. So typical of Ryne, and as noted in this morning's program, among his last wishes was his desire to thank everyone, his teammates, his fellow Hall of Famers, his many friends, but also the people who work at the ballpark and all the fans who cheered him, shared their memories with him, wrote to him, and more recently, prayed for him. Ryne was appreciative and grateful to you all. And for myself and so many others here today and beyond, thank you, Ryne. Thank you for the great moments, and also for the sincere and abiding friendship. Just as baseball will never forget you, we will never forget you, and we will always honor your memory.
Damn. That's one of the great orators, and certainly in American sports history, and really in American media history, rising to the moment for the eulogy of Ryne Sandberg. Bob Costas right there. That was beautiful.
We're glad that we were able to bring that to you. That's courtesy of Marquee. And they I don't know if they were still, they kind of kept running it this afternoon. It started at 10 and they kept running. I'm glad they did, because it gave people an opportunity to, if they happened to cross it, that they could watch it and hear all the people talk about how great Ryne was. And you're right about Bob. Like, he's, you know how I get whenever he's on the show. Like, I'm a huge fan of Bob's. And I like that even at the end there, the guy that doesn't break broke.
Yeah, because they had a real friendship. You know, that was beautiful stuff.
Why don't we give you a pair of Cubs tickets right now?
Me?
Not you. You can get in for free. 312-540-0670 if you're caller 6. We're going to set you up to the Washington game against the Cubs at Wrigley on September 7th. It's all provided by Bosch Power Tools. The more you Bosch, the more you feel like a Bosch. Back after this on The Score.
Spiegel and Holmes.
You know, we call today Feel Good Friday, so I'm trying to stick to that, you know?
I like it.
Afternoons on The Score.
Brad, David informs me that Tyson Bagent will be throwing out the first pitch Sunday at the Sox game. You might want to get out to that.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of tickets available, guys.
Oh, wow. Wow.
All right,
from the
buddy.
Top rope.
Thank you.
Safe travels, Brad.
Have a great weekend, guys.
All right, you too.
Have a great one. That is our guy, Brad Biggs. He is the football man of the Chicago Tribune.
Well, it's no part of the backup quarterback conversation, but it'll take a shot at the Sox.
Brad Biggs talks baseball with you.
He does it a lot. Takes a shot at everybody, doesn't he?
So shot. Are you going to be on Taylor Swift watch, or is that something that's not interesting to you?
I got my hands. I haven't even left yet. You know, usually I get there the day before. It's all business the next 24 hours, my friend.
That's business. I'd be part of the story, right? No,
that's not. I'm sticking to football here, Dave. All right. My interests aren't quite as broad as yours.
I'm just trying to help you out, man.
That's a wrap. I mean, Taylor Swift meant great business for the New Heights podcast.
Yeah, I probably got to watch that. I heard she's great on it.
I'm not surprised.
And that...
would you like to guess how many views it's gotten in 8 days?
Because Jason Kelsey was supposedly great in that podcast. How many views in 8 days? Let's see. More than the PBP, Voices of Baseball?
Barely.
I'll go with 2 million.
Times 10.
20 million views?
Matt checks out on that, yeah.
That is more than the PBP?
I mean, honestly, that's like kind of just fun with numbers.
I agree, Craig. I agree.
I'm on the YouTube of it right now. There are 45,000 comments.
Most of them are saying, I thought this was about baseball play-by-play. They were looking for the wrong one.
Yep, see, they messed up.
Happens to me all the time, man.
Done it?
All right, you're going away, so you send land the plane here.
I am going away. Thank you,
finally,
everybody.
They've locked you up. They finally got him.
Gotta
say. Finally.
Very grateful, man. What a crazy professional week with the anthem and the gig and the getting to work with all you fine people. Lawrence Holmes, you're a wonderful partner. Thanks, man. Thank you to Eddie Curry, who was on the show today. Thank you to Dan Wiederer, who was on the show today. Thank you to Sean Sears, who's going to give Alex Kuhn a run for his money. But Alex will be back on Monday, and that's delightful. And thank you to Chris Tannehill, who is the best in the business. Coming up next on The Score, it is Rami Makhlouf. So stay listening. Rami's very good at what he does. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. I will be back with you on the 2nd of September. Lawrence Holmes with guest hosts all next week right here on The Spiegel and Holmes Show on The Score.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Weeknd.